as we continue through Acts is from Acts 25. So Acts 25, and we'll read the whole chapter. Now 3 days after Festus had arrived in the province, he went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea, and the chief priests and the principal men of the Jews laid out their case against Paul, and they urged him, asking as a favor against Paul, that he summon him to Jerusalem, because they were planning to ambush to kill him, an ambush to kill him on the way. Festus replied that Paul was being kept at Caesarea, and that he himself intended to go there shortly. So said he, "Let the men of authority among you go down with me, and if there is anything wrong about the man, let them bring charges against him." And he stayed among them not more than 8 or 10 days, and he went down to Caesarea. And the next day he took his seat at the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. When he had arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him that they could not prove. Paul argued in his defense, "Neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar have I committed any offense." But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, said to Paul, "Do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and there be tried on these charges before me?" But Paul said, "I am standing before Caesar's tribunal, where I ought to be tried. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. If then I am a wrongdoer and have committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar." Then Festus, when he had finished with the council, answered, "To Caesar you have appealed, to Caesar you shall go." Now when some days had passed, Agrippa, the king, and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and greeted Festus. And as they stayed there many days, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There is a man left prisoner by Felix. And when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of the Jews laid out their case against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation against him. I answered them that it was not the custom of the Romans to give up anyone before the accused met the accuser face to face and had opportunity to make his defense concerning the charge laid against him. So when they came together here, I made no delay, but on that day took my seat at the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. When the accusers stood up, they brought no charge in his case of such evils as I supposed. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead, but whom Paul asserted to be alive. Being at a loss how to investigate these questions, I asked whether he wanted to go to Jerusalem and be tried there regarding them. But when Paul had appealed to be kept in custody for the decision of the emperor, I ordered him to be held until I could send him to Caesar. Then Agrippa said to Festus, "I would like to hear the man myself." "Tomorrow," he said, "you will hear him." So on the next day, Agrippa and Bernice came with great pomp, and they entered the audience hall with the military tribunes and the prominent men of the city. Then, at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in, and Festus said, "King Agrippa, and all who are present with us, you see this man about whom the Jewish people petitioned me, both in Jerusalem and here, shouting that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he had done nothing deserving death. And as he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to go ahead and send him. But I have nothing definite to write to my lord about him. Therefore, I have brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we have examined him, I may have something to write. For it seems to me unreasonable in sending a prisoner not to indicate the charges against him." Just that far, and Jason will come up next to us.
Governor Festus, it seems, goes about things a bit differently to his predecessor, Governor Felix, because if you recall last week's passage, Felix kept delaying the inevitable. Felix knew that he had to deal with Paul's case, he knew that he had to deal with Paul's message, but he kept putting both of those things off, if you remember. Felix didn't get around to responding to the gospel. And then he left Paul in prison for the rest of his tenure there as the governor. But this new governor in chapter 25, Festus, seems to be quite the opposite. From everything we can tell here in the passage, Festus is the kind of person who likes to get on with things as quickly as possible. He arrives in Caesarea in that first verse as the new governor, and despite what has probably been a long and arduous sea journey from Rome to get there, within a couple of days he's keen to get up to Jerusalem, make contact with the Jewish religious leaders, establish diplomatic relations there on that front. But then again, he doesn't plan on wasting time in Jerusalem, verse 4, where the Jews petition him about Paul. He says, no, I'm not going to send and have Paul brought here. I'm about to go there. Yeah, the whole diplomatic mission to Jerusalem, verse 6 tells us, was only going to be for 8 or 10 days. So he himself has got things to do, you know. He's not messing around, it seems. And then back in Caesarea when he gets there, the trial happens quickly. And when it happens, Festus consults with the council, makes a decision, and that's it. To Caesar you will go. It's all unfolding rather quickly compared to last week's chapter and the week before that. This is, compared to Felix's handling of the matter, for example, Festus seems to be a man who likes to get on with things. The problem is, despite wanting to get on with this, Festus has just got no idea in the world what this is all about. He's confused. He is at a loss, in his own words, as he concedes to Agrippa there in verse 20, at a loss as to how he should have been handling this case. He's stepped off the boat into this strange new world of Palestine, and immediately he's finding himself out of his depths altogether over this, which is probably the most bizarre case that he's ever going to have to rule on, the Jews versus Paul. And so if you cast your eye back across that chapter, you'll notice that for most of the passage, Festus is absolutely scrambling to try to work out this bizarre case. And for much of the passage, rather than investigating the actual case of the Jews versus Paul, Festus seems to be defending his own actions in how he's handled the case. From verses 14 to 21, if you look through there, we've got that whole chunk, 8 verses there, Festus trying to sound out King Agrippa as to how he could have gone about things and how he ended up going out about things up until this point. And then again in verses 24 to 27 at the end of that chapter is all Festus again before the whole council, or the whole court that's gathered before King Agrippa. He is again taking time to defend his actions as to everything that's transpired so far and everything that he's done. Painting himself in a good light, of course, as we're used to in recent chapters, the Romans doing that. So we could probably think of chapter 25 really as coming in two halves. First of all, we have the account of Festus being at a loss as to what this case is even about, how he handles the situation, verses 1 to 12. And then in verses 13 to 27, it's really about Festus justifying the way that he's handled this case. Reason being that this case against Paul is just totally absurd. Charges are groundless. Paul is clearly innocent. This chapter, it's like deja vu. Paul's case runs around the cycle all over again today, but nothing seems to have changed. The charges haven't developed from what we can gather, and the verdict is certainly exactly what we've seen all the way through so far. It's exactly the same verdict we saw last week, and the week before that, and the week before that. Paul is innocent. So he says in verse 8, he argues his defense, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I committed any offense. And so too Paul, as he says that, he knows that Festus knows that that's true. He knows the charges are false. Paul tells Festus, I'm standing here in Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. To the Jews I have done no wrong. As you yourself, Festus, know very well. Paul's defense is still as solid as ever, and his logic that follows from this is perfect. Nobody has the right now to send an innocent man to Jerusalem to be judged by these lawless Jewish leaders who throw in false charges everywhere. He goes on, if I am a wrongdoer and if I've committed anything for which I deserve to die, I do not seek to escape death. But if there is nothing to their charges against me, no one can give me up to them. I appeal to Caesar. Paul's innocent, and Festus knows these things. Festus knows that the Jewish leaders' charges are completely baseless and that Paul has done nothing wrong. He even says that much in the passage. He says it in verse 18. Implicitly he says that to Agrippa in his consultation with Agrippa, and he says it explicitly in his address before the whole court in verse 25. Nevertheless, although Paul is clearly innocent, nevertheless the heat against Paul is still as hot as ever, if not even hotter. And we note that the Jews there, verse 3, are still plotting to kill Paul on the road, the same thing they were plotting to do 2 years ago, before Claudius Lysias intervened, if you remember. But even more so now, it's even more tense now, because 2 years ago it was just 40 men who were plotting that scheme, trying to get the Jewish leaders on board with their plan. Now it's the Jewish leaders themselves who are plotting to kill Paul on the road. So the problem for Festus here in this chapter is that he's trying to manage two things. On the one hand, he needs to pursue personal justice for Paul. On the other hand, he needs to establish a social stability in this region of Judea that he's just assumed control of. So Festus, at a loss, is caught in that tension because Paul is innocent. But the heat against him is furious. He can't accept the petition from the Jewish leaders to have Paul put to death, but then again, he can't just release him either. So he concedes Paul's request to be taken to a higher court in Rome. He's probably glad to have it taken out of his jurisdiction. But the problem, of course, is that to send Paul on his way, Festus needs to still work out this bizarre case, because he can't just send Paul to the high court. He's also got to get a statement and send a statement with him as to the charges, as to why he's going. And there he comes back to the whole absurdity of this situation. There are no charges that anyone has accepted against Paul. Claudius Lysias rejected them. Felix rejected them. Festus now rejects them. So what's the emperor going to make of Paul suddenly being sent up the line to the high court without any charges against him? Shouldn't it have just been case dismissed way back? Are all these commanders and governors in Palestine totally incompetent? So Festus has to try to put something together on that score. And he calls people in. He asks King Agrippa, first of all, and then he gathers everyone else together too, and he asks everyone quite bluntly. Verse 25, here's the verdict. I found that he had done nothing deserving death. And as he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to go ahead and send him. But I have nothing definite to write to my lord about him. Therefore, I've brought him before you all, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after we've examined him, I may have something to write. For it seems unreasonable to me to send a prisoner not indicating the charges against him. Do you think? If this wasn't so serious, it would be thoroughly comical. It's hilarious. Anyway, there's Festus. We've now met Festus. He's at a total loss as to what to do. The only thing he has clocked is what lies at the centre of this whole clash, and he tells it to Agrippa in verse 19 there. He's done nothing wrong. They brought none of the charges I would have assumed for such a case. Rather, they had certain points of dispute with him about their own religion and about a certain Jesus who was dead but whom Paul asserted to be alive. Paul, on the other hand, is not at all confused. Paul carries on as normal, even now taking the initiative to move this case forward a little bit. And Paul's confidence there is probably helped by a little detail we read a few weeks ago, if you recall. If I can back the truck up a couple of chapters to Acts 23, you might remember that Jesus appeared to Paul and told him what his next calling was. In chapter 23, verse 11, the Lord stood by Paul and said, "Take courage, Paul, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome." While everyone else here in chapter 25 is floundering around, not knowing what to do, not knowing how exactly to proceed, Paul has the luxury of knowing where this is all headed. So amidst all the chaos, with people still pleading and scheming and plotting for his execution all this time later, Paul just keeps doing what he's doing, and he just follows the calling that he's received from Jesus. He knows he has to go to Rome anyway, so he makes a decisive move. "I appeal to Caesar." A gutsy move, probably more than we could even understand in our almost opposite cultural context, but to ask for the most final kind of judgment from probably the least merciful forum, appearing in the courts of the most powerful man in the world, Festus must be thinking to himself, does this Paul guy have a death wish or something? He doesn't even do anything wrong. Has he got one of those self-destructive personalities? Quite the opposite, in fact. Paul is content here to submit to the governing authorities of the land. The correct authorities, he insists on. He doesn't want to be handed over to the Jews, who have no authority over him and they have no charge against him. Rather, he asks for proper justice under the right law of the day. Why? Well, as I say, for one reason, because he knows he's been called to Rome anyway by Jesus himself, who is sovereign over everything, and it's better to go there in chains and fulfill his calling than to risk going back the other way to Jerusalem. But for another thing, he's done nothing wrong, and he has a basic civil right to appeal for justice. Paul says in chapter 25, verse 10, "I'm standing in Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you yourself know very well. If I'm a wrongdoer, if I've committed anything for which I deserve to die, kill me. But if there's nothing in their charge against me, no one can give me up to those Jews. I appeal to Caesar." But we might well ask, why is this case dragging on like so? Paul will be in custody for the rest of Acts, by the way. Sorry, spoiler alert. Paul will be in custody for the rest of Acts. But already we've got to be asking the question, if Paul is Jesus' apostle and Jesus' gospel has to go to the ends of the earth, then why is there such a formidable obstacle in his way? Shouldn't the way be cleared and paved for Paul to get on with this mission? Instead of supporting Paul, it seems as if the sovereign God might even be hindering Paul from doing what he was called to do. And at that level, this book of Acts is just entirely counterintuitive to our earthly minds, the way we see things and the way we think of things. Jesus commissioned this gospel, and yet, if anything, according to the way we tend to think, it seems like he's obstructing it from being carried out now. But God's thoughts are not like our thoughts. God's ways are not like our ways. He tells us through the prophet Isaiah, this is God's gospel mission and this is how he has ordained that it will be. And Paul can patiently endure because somehow he can see what's going on, even in the midst of all the injustice and the suffering that he's facing. He can see what's going on in a bigger picture. In fact, the mission is going great guns. This passage reminded me of a couple of letters that Paul wrote to the churches. The first one he hasn't written yet at this point in Acts 25. He's about to write it just a little bit later in this ongoing prison saga. The letter to the Philippians, where he gives us his take on how all this is happening and what's going on in this struggle. And as he does that in the letter to the Philippians, he is supremely confident in what God was doing all this time. He says from Philippians verse 1 and 12, I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. To advance the gospel. How? It's become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers and sisters, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. This mission is not being hindered at all by prison. Paul being in prison. It's advancing the gospel. The Roman soldiers and everyone else in prison with him are discovering the gospel through all of these trials Paul's going through. And they know that there's only one reason for them. It's Jesus Christ, the man who was dead, but yet whom Paul claims is alive. It's exactly as we saw in chapter 16, if you remember, where Paul was in prison in Philippi. And the guard came in. And a church was born in Philippi, to whom he now writes that letter back to. Outside of prison, out in the real world, the wider world, back out in society, all the Christians are becoming more bold and courageous and speaking about Jesus all the more than they ever were, without fear. Despite what it seems to our earthly eyes and the way our brains are wired, this gospel mission is full steam ahead. The second letter that Paul wrote that came to mind was Romans that we read before, which he wrote, if you remember, from just back in chapter 20 when he visited Corinth, just before going to Jerusalem, where all this whole prison saga kicked off. And just before all that, he taught us, as he wrote in that letter to the Romans, that we should submit to the governing authorities. And now he's backing that up in his own experience. And he models it superbly in this passage here. He pleads here very clearly for justice to be upheld. So he's teaching in his example not that we should just let the government get away with whatever they want, let the government ride roughshod over us, let the government do whatever they feel like and just live with the consequences. No, he's seeking justice here, but he's doing it from a proper position, humbled under their authority. And he can do that. He can submit. Because he knows that in all things, God is sovereign. Ultimately, Paul's fate is not going to be decided by the Jews or by Claudius Lysias or by Felix or by Festus or by King Agrippa, who we'll come back to next week. Whatever his circumstances are, he knows from one day to the next that his life is in the hands of the Lord God. So Paul needn't be distressed about his imprisonment. This is just the nature of this gospel mission. And this is just the reality of the world this gospel seeks to minister to. Paul's very identity, since Acts chapter 9, Paul's very identity has been totally bound up with the Lord Jesus, and he's been copping hate for that ever since. And so too, you and I might find the same today. Because the name of Jesus, the one who was dead but now is risen, that name Jesus still generates an awful lot of hate. Like the hate from the Jews in our passage here in the last couple of chapters. Hate that makes no sense whatsoever. And hate that gets directed squarely at people who've chosen to follow Jesus. Entirely because they have chosen to follow Jesus. You and I could probably log into Facebook this afternoon. It wouldn't take as long, would it, before we go searching. If we went searching, we would find a post pretty quickly where somebody has just blasted a whole rant of absolute sheer hatred for Christians in the comment section. Wouldn't take long to find, would it? Even among our own Facebook connections, we've probably experienced that. An unreasonable, unbridled hatred towards Christians is not a first century Jewish problem. So again, we find ourselves asking almost 2,000 years later now, why is there such opposition to this gospel mission? Is Jesus saving the world or what? Why doesn't he just wipe out all of that opposition so that this gospel mission can do what it has to do? And again, the answer, first of all, must be the same, because his ways are higher than our ways. And his gospel is wonderfully slow and patient. You see, while we're asking the question on behalf of Paul here in chapter 25, we might also ask the question on behalf of, say, Stephen, back in chapter 7, if you recall. Stephen, why did Jesus' disciple Stephen get taken down like that, suffering not just injustice but execution by the likes of Paul? Because this gospel is wonderfully slow and patient. And even when we have received it, the gospel has a whole lot of work to do in us. It's got a whole lot of cleaning up and transforming, reshaping to do. Like Paul, like every other believer, you and I, in that sense, are a work in progress. And we might be thankful that God has a very slow and patient gospel mission. And as for all those people who still oppose this message of salvation, like these Jewish leaders in Acts 25, or those Facebook connections we've got this very day, well, God's wonderful patience extends even to people who still yet resist him. God's love still extends to hostile people, like Paul once was, whom God desires to save and then slowly but surely transform. We might actually be ever thankful for this slow gospel. In the meantime, we should expect opposition. We should expect hostility even to this simple message of forgiveness and salvation through Jesus Christ. It sounds simple to us. It's offensive, in case you've forgotten it. It's offensive when someone first hears that, the idea that they should need forgiving, the idea that they should need saving. It's offensive, especially when it comes from the lips of people who clearly still need forgiving and saving themselves. But nonetheless, we must do it. And as we hold out this gospel, we must stand our ground. We must stand together in our faith as Christ's ambassadors, despite all the hostility against us. And doing that means not getting baited into the hostility, but remaining in the gentle and humble way that Jesus taught us. That's the only way to show others the truth that they need to connect to. We don't need to show them themselves. We need to show them Jesus. And so Paul explained that much in the letter that we read before to the Philippian church. Verse 27 of chapter 1, only let your manner of life be worthy of the gospel of Christ, so that whether I come and see you or am absent, I may hear of you that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind striving side by side for the faith of the gospel, and not frightened in anything by your opponents. Why? This is a clear sign to them of their destruction, but of your salvation, and that from God. So we might find ourselves asking that why question all the time. Why did my boss start treating me poorly as soon as he found out I was a Christian? Why is everything else politically incorrect these days, but it's somehow still okay to make Christians the butt of every joke? Why is our society these days so passionate about tolerance and at the same time burning with unbridled hatred for anyone, for everyone who has chosen to follow Jesus? Why are there people out there who would scream and rant and try to deny Christians should have a voice at all in the social issues of our day in such a democratic society? Why? 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 The question will always be there. And the answer will always be the same. Because this is the landscape on which this beautiful, patient gospel of love is playing out. And this is the way that God has ordained that it should progress. In the face of senseless opposition, to the end that injustice and suffering will come to those who speak his name, but that we should remain steadfast in our faith, in the ways that Jesus taught us, walking the walk, having talked the talk. The cultural context may have shifted since Paul's day, but we should expect the same reality as Paul experienced. He goes on and finishes that chapter, "For it has been granted to you." Wonderful way of spinning everything around on us. "It has been granted to you that for the sake of Christ you should not only believe in him, but also suffer for his sake. Engaged in the same conflict that you saw I had, and now hear that I still have." And our response should be the same as well. Not to be dragged down into the unlawful rabble, but to hold true to the faith and the calling by which we've been called, so that even in the earthly wash-up of all these things, we should be seen as blameless. Let the world kick and scream. But may we always seek to respond with an unfailing trust in God and a love that perseveres even to those who still resist it. And may God grant us strength and unity and conviction as we stay that course, come whatever may. Sing.